hearing starting 1931, there was nothing to do with Doland. There was no business, and I had no money, absolutely nothing. But my Uncle Harry had sent me $50 for Christmas. And my old landlady, Mrs. T.A. Zimmerman, bless her memory and soul, that dear woman, she called me up on the phone. She was a rough and tough old regular university landlady. She and her old husband, T.A., Ma Zimmerman, everybody knows Ma Zimmerman. Gosh, she's had hundreds of boys that went through her room and house. She called me up and she said, "What are you doing out there in South Dakota?" He said, "You going to mount anything? You get back down here and go to the university." He said, "You don't need to stay out there." I said, "I don't have any money." She said, "Well, you don't need any money. You come down here and work for me, and you can earn your board and room working for me." And I said, "All right, I'll do it." So I hitchhiked down to the University of Minnesota. I got a ride in a bus, on a truck, and I can still remember the truck. And I can't remember the man's name now, but he's in the trucking business yet. And I used to ride back and forth in the back of that truck whenever I'd want to ride home. I had $50, and the tuition was $52.50. And when I got down there, I borrowed $5 from Mrs. Zimmerman. I paid my tuition. I didn't have any books. And I used to borrow the books from the library. Then I worked for Mrs. Zimmerman in the morning to serve breakfast to the boys before they went off to school. Then I'd make the beds. Then I'd come on home and serve a meal at night and help her do the dishes. Then after that, I'd work in the drugstore. I got a job in a drugstore. And then after I got through work in the drugstore, I'd try to study. And I had one quarter like that. Then my father, during that time, this is 1931, decided to move
to Huron.
From Doland to Huron.
Yeah.
And I went home that spring in April. And never came back to the university until 1937.
Your brother went then.
My brother went back. But he came back out of the university too. He never got his degree. He was within a quarter of getting his degree.
Right.
So we both went home and stayed in Huron to help Dad with that store. But I don't regret it a bit. I remember when I came back to get my stuff, my rooming house, my father gave me the Model A Ford, and I come back and the guys want to know what was wrong. I didn't tell them. I never had a car back there, and I was living it up real good, you know. And I finally told them, "Boys, I'm checking out of school." Then they knew, but we had the car for a couple of days. That was really something. It was a Model A, really living it up, having dates and doing the big time. So then I went back to Huron, and I met Muriel that year.
Was this before you went to the pharmacy school?
Yes. Yes. Oh, yes. I met Muriel in the winter of 1931, the first year I was there, at a dance, Huron College dance at one of the hotels, the Marvin Hewitt Hotel. And I can remember her just as plain as now. I mean, I just see her just vividly. She had bangs, and I thought she was very pretty. And I got a dance with her, but she didn't pay much attention to me, really didn't. She had a couple of guys on the string around there. And I remember a little later when I'd been in the drugstore, she and Betty Halpenny, lady of a girl by the name of Halpenny. I was kind of thinking that maybe that Betty was better anyway about that time. Why, she and Muriel would come into the drugstore and get Cokes. And I like to tell Muriel about this because when she used to walk through that front door, there'd be a sunlight, you know, I could see, but just like an x-ray. I told her she always had the prettiest legs. And she really did. She, you know, she was very shapely and she had very pretty legs. And she'd come in the store and then we'd talk. Then I asked her for a date or two to go dancing. She liked to go dancing. And that's about all we had to do around there. We'd go out Wednesday night and go dancing. And she had other boyfriends, and I'd have to work all the time in the drugstore. And after I'd get through work, I'd come out to the dance, and then sometimes she'd go home with me, you know, and she'd work it out so that we'd have a date. Then we started going pretty steady about 1933, after I came back from pharmacy school.
That was a decision. You decided you might as well get that degree. Or
my father decided that really for me. He one morning I came down to work, and he said, "Son, I'm afraid this depression's going to last forever, so to speak." He said, "You better get something under your belt, and you can go on out." It was a short course, pharmacy school. Nothing to brag about, except I learned more there in those few months I went to pharmacy school than I learned in all any 5 years of my life. It was fantastic the way they taught you force feeding.
Really.
Just incredible. I passed the same state boards that the four-year students did. And I did it all from January till June.
My God. Force feeding.
I did it. I studied every course. And we went from 8 o'clock in the morning till 12. from 1 until 6, from 7:30 till 10:30, 5 days a week, solid classwork. Then you studied after 10:30.
Sure, you gotta do your homework.
And I'd be up there on the third floor, I remember there, and we'd have up there questions and answers. I memorized the pharmacopoeia. I knew every drug by memory and its definition, its origin, its Latin name, its dose. I never missed a one. My father said, like we're sitting here, went through the whole book, over 2,000 of them, just like that. And all those formulas in the National Formulary, I had a retentive mind, and I was just memorize them. And I never missed a problem in chemistry in all the time I was at the university or pharmacy school. That's a fact. I like to study, and I could do it good. And not only that, in pharmacy, not unlike other things, you're either right or wrong. The dose for apomorphine was 1/60th of a grain, and that's it. You know, I mean, if you gave 1/40th of a grain, something went wrong. Yeah. You gave 1/30th of a grain, something went worse. You either right or wrong. You knew the definition of a drug. You know, if it was acacia or something, you knew what its formula was. You knew what its purpose was. Each one of these drugs, digitalis, you knew what it was. So there was just no way that you could be wrong.
Denver was kind of a new world for you, wasn't it?
Yes, it was a lovely place.
Isn't it a lovely city? Yes.
I like Denver very much, and I have even to this date. But I learned so much there. During that period of time in the Depression, I was not well. And that's really why, one of the other reasons I left South Dakota. The dust storms wore on me. I was very nervous, despite feeling, active and peppy and all that, but I'd get terrible cases of indigestion, which wasn't indigestion at all. It was nothing more like psychosomatic.
Mm-hmm.
I literally would collapse many times. I'd just faint away.
The dust storms were pretty bad in kind of an intense way. I mean, the dust was thick and...
Nobody will ever know what it was like. My God, man, let me tell you. It is impossible for a person to know. The whole topsoil blew off. It was as hard as concrete. 2 or 3 feet of black loam would blow off and blow up over barns. I can remember walking right off the roads, right over tops of houses and barns, just like solid mountains. And it's just the ditches were all full of dirt and silt. And my scout troop picked up several thousand Indian arrowheads that we used to pick up, you know, after all the topsoil had blown off. Those Indian arrowheads had worked their way on down through. We mounted them all on panels and took them to the state fair. You wouldn't believe it. It didn't rain, and it would be 115, 117, 114 temperature in the shade, and we had no water. We used to go out and buy bottled water, the water supply, and here in South Dakota, you couldn't drink it. It ran green out of the spigots. There was grasshoppers. I saw grasshoppers eat the paint right off the house, eat the bark right off the trees. We used to have to put screens in front of the cars to keep the grasshoppers out of the radiator, and the most horrible sight, the most fearsome sight you'd see coming out of the west, because the wind used to blow from the southwest and the west. You see this huge, rolling, billowing purple, because the sun would be, they'd come in the late afternoon generally, and it just rolling, huge mountains of just like clouds rolling like that. Big dust come through the house, and just come through everything, just all over, just fine silt. Mother said to me, she said for years she never had a home that you didn't have it just constantly filled with dust. People used to go around with masks on to keep the dust out of your lungs. And dry and no crops. People were discouraged. I used to think I just never could, you know, that couldn't take it. I don't see how people did. Many of them didn't take it.
That's the thing I don't understand, how people year after year could...
Well, there was I used to say to Daddy, why don't we leave? He said, where would we go?
Where would we go?
And not only that, what are we going to leave with?
Yeah.
We had a tough time to pay our taxes. We had a big, we always were behind. We had a rather big store, and we'd be taking in $25 in a day. With $50,000, $60,000 worth of inventory at that time, that was a lot of inventory.
Oh, sure, it's still in.
We wouldn't get anything, you know, just nothing. You wouldn't believe it. We did much of it in barter. We used to trade for chickens and eggs and meat for drugs. Then we'd use the chickens and the eggs in the drugstore for our luncheonette. And we'd serve a full meal for 20 cents and 25 cents to the truck drivers. I told the boys out home when I was there, I used to sleep in the basement of the drugstore to be the first man up in the morning. Get the truck drivers, they're the only people that had any money.
They were passing through.
They were passing through. And
yeah.
We just, it just were, it just wasn't anything.
Okay, I'll change this now.
How long are you going to want to do the talk tonight? Because I think otherwise we're going to have to go a little faster, Ralph.
All right, let's go. I talk too much about this.
Well, I know. Your interest is, but otherwise we're not going to get through the book. And,
okay.
Now, I'll tell you what this is here. We'll get right at this. We'll run along a little.
We're prepared to stay all night.
All right, well, that's right. We're doing all right here now. We'll run along. Now, this scene that you have here, this 42, is when I was at 945 14th Avenue Southeast, Minneapolis. I was at the university. I was then a sophomore, married. And this is one room. Here was our bed. Here was my desk. Here was our couch, our lamp. This is a picture of Roosevelt. I still have it. And
he was really an influence, wasn't he?
Very great influence all the way back. My life. I was a Roosevelt Democrat. To me, he was a great...
Was he a strong influence after your father, too?
Oh, yes. Well, my goodness, me.
Yes, this was the time.
I mean, let's face it.
He was the man.
I remember when he made his speech about if you need a loan on your home, call me. Well, mm-hmm. we were one of the families that got a homeowner's loan.
Yeah.
So we could get... so we could get our house painted, you know, and so we could get some screens. You know, these people nowadays forget. And we weren't poor people. You know, I've never really thought of ourselves as being poor. We were just, things had just gone bad. I remember some of the most, I think you have to push this down. Yeah. Some of the most impressive, some of the best farmers in our part of the country that had, whose sons and daughters had gone off to big schools and all, they lost everything. Everybody lost everything. The insurance companies owned the farms. And, well, I went back there and I decided to get a college education. I never knew how long I could stay. That's why I never took up the law, otherwise I would have been a lawyer. I just wanted to get an education. This is a picture one time when I was up visiting with a friend of mine whose father was with some seed company, Northland Seed Company, Ledbetter. Jack Ledbetter is a friend of mine. He's out in Tucson now. He works for IDS. Here we are with our Coronado radio. That's one of the things that I got for a wedding present. And our little lamp. We didn't have much. I was smoking a pipe in those days. And Muriel there, she was working downtown for the Investors Syndicate, or now known as Investors
Diversified. Let's backtrack just a minute and tell about the marriage. And you decided to get married.
We got married in 1937. Is that right? 1936. I forgot. Almost. September. And been courting for quite a while. Decided to just want to get married. And Muriel was working as a bookkeeper for the Northwestern Public Service Company. She had a job. I had gotten no salary up to then. Then I got a job, $15 a week. Working in the store. We had a little house that we rented for $15 a month. Muriel had been living with her father. She bought a refrigerator, I remember. We had that refrigerator for years. And she had some furniture, and we set up housekeeping. She used to go up to visit with her father up at Big Stone Lake near Milbank, Minnesota, Milbank, South Dakota. We set the wedding date, I can remember so well. In the fall, but we didn't. Is it running?
I'm worried about this little machine here. As long as we have that.
Running on the other.
I know we're running on the other. That's why I'm not as worried.
It's running. Let's see.
Well, this thing isn't going around. You see?
Oh no! You got something wrong.
Something's
here.
Wrong here.
Here, you've got missed out all about my wedding.
No, we didn't. We got on here. That's the nice thing about having your very smart press secretary. Having a backup on this.
Oh, it works.
Now it's that. Sure. I just want to see if this is running. No, that's not running.
Well, it won't be running when you got it down.
Sure. No, I don't think so. I don't know. No, it's supposed to. It runs usually when we had it up before. It ran. That's my double check on it. Come on, run.
Well,
oh, damn it.
Okay. Here, let's get Ted play with that one.
All right, why don't we do that? Yeah, well, as long as we got it on the other one.
Well,
Let you Why don't you move that microphone over a little bit?
The reason that we didn't get married earlier was we just didn't think we could afford it. And Muriel, by this time, had more or less decided that maybe she was going to go to California with her father. And I thought, oh boy, if I let her get away, she'll never get back. And so we got the proposing job done and gave her an engagement ring right around Christmas. And then next September, we got married at the Presbyterian Church in Huron, South Dakota. Reverend Cattell was the minister. We did it at 8 o'clock in the morning for the simple reason that we couldn't afford to close the drugstore up over an hour. And we needed the business. And we had $65 as total sum of money we had that had been given by her father to me for a wedding present. And I borrowed my dad's car and we went on a honeymoon. We took my sister Frances as far as Watertown because she needed a ride to go over to get a job. And then we went to Minneapolis. And then from Minneapolis to Duluth, went up on the lake shore. We came on back to here, and we were only gone 5 days, 4 or 5 days. Excuse me. On the way coming back, we ran into a cow, killed a cow, damaged the car. Farmer wanted to sue us. Cow was in the road, of course. That didn't bother him a bit. And that was about it. Grandpa, her father, was a wonderful man. He was a wonderful man. He'd been a very successful businessman. Muriel was come from a family that had had good, pretty good living, a rather conservative family, quite well-to-do. He'd been a director of the bank, the James River Valley Bank. He'd contributed large sums of money to the university, to the college. Both of his sons had their own airplanes as young men. Oh, he made a lot of money. He had four or five produce houses, and he and his brothers. As I told Muriel, she'd always been spoiled as a little girl. She was her daddy's favorite. And yet the Depression wiped him out. He sold all that business for little or nothing. He sold a beautiful home that cost the bill $12,000 in the year 1912. He sold it, which you can imagine, he sold it for $2,500 and all the property. He had beautiful property down along the river. A lovely home that Muriel's folks had. Big, beautiful home and big orchards. Then he went up and took that little money that he got from that and went up to Big Stone Lake and developed a resort up there. They had a lake home of their own up there. She'd always lived well. They traveled every summer. They always had a big car. I've always said, you know, that she really didn't know what it was to be in that depression. The chain operations came in for Swift and Company and all and picked up the poultry and cut down his business. And then the depression swept him out.
So she knew.
She knew the depression too.
Yeah.
We were depression.
And these pictures
children.
Were taken when?
These pictures were taken in 1937 when we went to the University of Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
Winter, spring, I think it says.
Well, she went too then.
No, but I got her.
You got a picture taken
winter,
of her anyway.
Winter, spring, 1938. This was so she'd get into football games.
Oh.
This is our student faculty privilege card. See?
I see.
She was the wife of a.
I see.
Of a student.
Right.
And we all lived in the house, 945 14th Avenue Southeast, with a group of young people. There was another young married couple there.
See.
They're now presently in Nebraska someplace. Don Williams and his wife, Pug, and Z.B. Lum, a whole lot of fellows that we knew.
When did you get that honorary degree?
That's at Huron, South Dakota.
Oh, right.
She was given an honorary degree.
And this was when you graduated?
This is when I graduated, magna cum laude, University of
Minnesota.
Minnesota,
right.
Yep. Okay. Now, here's our Humphrey's Drugstore, and I've worked in there as the Humphrey's Drugstore.
How old were you there?
When I was from the mayor of Minneapolis, I came over.
I see.
I must have been about 35.
Uh-huh.
And here's that same old radio. We had that for years, as you can see.
Yeah.
God, I just got rid of that a few years ago. And there's Nancy, and there was Skipper right there. That's my oldest son. I just talked to him on the phone tonight. Here's Humphrey's Drugstore. You see the pig?
Yeah?
Well, that pig is that's for our veterinary supplies.
Oh, I see.
My brother and I got my dad to take that pig down because we didn't think it was very modern.
Dignified.
You know what? The farmers rolled in and they complained and they wrote to their letters to the editor.
And they wanted the pig
back. They wanted the pig back up. And so we had to put the pig back up. And now, and after dad died, my brother Ralph took and put the pig in the back of the store and we extended the store into the back. It's much better than this now. It's much more modern front than even that.
And when now raising a family, well, this was another
story. This is when I was mayor of Minneapolis.
This was when you're mayor,
mm-hmm.
right. Oh, this
yeah.
was the then,
yeah.
I see, right.
Yeah.
Okay, then really this picture goes...
That's right. This is still when I was mayor of Minneapolis.
Were you mayor then? Oh, you weren't teaching then?
No, I was teaching. This is at McAllister College,
yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, that's right.
That's right. And I'm running for mayor here.
Yeah.
And this is when I was a broadcaster at WTCN.
And that was after your first
while
try
I was
for mayor.
Teaching, yeah, yeah. After I, for my first try.
Right.
McAllister College.
Now, how did you get, who gave you the first idea of running for political office? I mean, where did you get that
Oh,
from?
I had that in my craw for
a long time.
Yes.
I mean, even when you were teaching, this was something
yes.
in the back of your head
yes.
you wanted to someday do
someday
this.
Someday do. But one day I was walking down the street in Minneapolis. I'd had the adult education program and the workers' education program under WPA. And I'd gotten to know the trade union people, a lot of the teachers around, and traveled. I'd spoken a lot around Minneapolis. Little church groups and all, and union halls, and I remember that George Phillips and George Merck, two labor leaders, came up to me in front of the Nicollet Hotel one day and said, "How would you like to run for mayor?" It was 1943. Well, I didn't know. I thought, well, I was going to be in the military, in the army, and I thought, well, I said, why not? I'm interested. What do you want to talk about? So we went in and talked, and we went on inside. And they told me that they thought they'd get the labor endorsement for me if I wanted to run. It was just 19 days before the primary. And I listened to them, and I told them what I thought my problems would be. And they said, well, why don't you give it a try? So I filed, and darn if I didn't come in second in the
without much money. You didn't have much
money. Oh, I didn't have anything then. And I went on into the general election, and I came within 5,000, about 5,000 votes of winning. When I got all through, they left me with the bills. My wife and I had to pay off $1,300 with the campaign bills.
My God.
Do I remember?
You had a lot of people, all your students helping and that sort of thing?
Oh,
this
yes,
was a
they worked hard for me.
Now, what about that newscaster job?
Well, I used to get $200 a month for that.
Mm-hmm. And how, what did it involve? At the school?
Just, it was a 10 to 10:15, 5 nights a week.
5 nights a week.
Mm-hmm.
And the teaching?
And I was teaching during the day.
Now tell me about the teaching. That's important.
Well, I was a professor of political science, and I was the chief instructor for the Army Air Corps training detachment, 347th training detachment. They needed a trainer. The McAllister College had a contract with the U.S. Air Army, and they had to teach these young fellows that were becoming officers basic social science courses, and so I was their chief instructor. And did the teaching for them all during that year. And they gave me the full rank. But besides that, I taught civilian students.
Mm-hmm.
I worked like a dog. I had several classes, you know, several assignments every day. And besides that, I was out organizing. In the spare time during that time, I was putting together the Democrats and farmer laborites into one party. And I wasn't supposed to be doing that, but I did.
And before all this, you'd gone down to Louisiana State for
yes,
your...
Yes, I got my
master's
degree.
And that was a new world, too. This was your first trip south, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, I wanted to go south. I wanted to go south.
Right.
And when I graduated from the University of Minnesota in 1939, I had several scholarships offered. I remember there was some Northwestern and Wisconsin and Illinois, as I recollect, and there were a couple others. But those, you know, the political science department would get these indications that you could get a scholarship. But there was a student at the University of Minnesota by the name of Howard Penniman, who is out here at Georgetown now. And he had come from Louisiana State University. And it just seemed to me like it would be interesting. I got to like Howard, and I thought, well, it might be interesting to go to a school like he'd come from. So I was married and had a baby. So we just took off and went down to Louisiana. I went on down there to try to find a place to live. I damn near starved to death while I was down there, I'll be frank to tell you. But we made it. I sent my wife back in April because I just couldn't afford to keep her, and we used every nickel we had to get her back. And then I was so broke I didn't have enough money to get home, so I had to get a job working for the university while they were doing some research work for the legislature.
What kind of research work?
Oh, on the reorganization of the legislature,
mm-hmm.
reorganization of state government. It was very interesting. I was down there right after Earl Long had been defeated and Sam Jones had become governor, and they had a big reform movement, which didn't reform much. But it was really fascinating. I met Russell Long while I was there during that time
mm-hmm.
and saw the kind of campaign that they operated down there. Now, let's take a look at this.
And from there, you went to McAllister.
From there, I went back to Minnesota to go to graduate school.
Oh, yes.
I had an offer to go to Princeton, which was my greatest desire in life. I wanted to graduate from Princeton like I've never wanted to do anything, because Woodrow Wilson had been president at Princeton. And Dr. Carpenter was the head of the political science department at Princeton, and I got a fellowship there, $500 or so. But I was afraid to go with the family, my wife and little baby. I just thought I'd get there, and I'd had such a tough time in Louisiana that we'd just starve. Wouldn't be able to make it. I had no other money, nobody to back me. So I went back to Minnesota and started studying for my PhD degree there in Minnesota, and did some of my coursework, went through school there, and I was offered a teaching assistantship at $600. I told them that was too little, and they raised it to $1,100. And I fulfilled that requirement for a quarter. And then I got a job teaching with WPA. I taught in the summer school for WPA to train the WPA teachers to teach. People that had been hired on a WPA teaching project, I was their trainer. And I taught 200 or 300 of them up at Duluth at the State Teachers College all summer. They liked my work and they offered me a job. And they offered me a job at $135 a month, and I want to tell you that was big money.
Yes.
And finally, I got to $150 a month, and I took it. And I was the district director of workers' education.
What did that involve?
That involved working with adult education and trade unions and setting up a recreation program, a literacy program, a public speaking program, a parliamentary law program. And we had 2 or 3 labor colleges, one in Minneapolis, one in St. Paul, one in Duluth, one in Austin. And I had thousands of trade unionists around the state in these night courses. Everything from drawings, I forget what you call them, you know, all kinds of line work. And I hired the teachers. Then I worked my way up the line until I was a divisional director in WPA. I did all the training and reemployment to liquidate WPA. Put the men in vocational training schools, got them jobs, worked with the employers. Then after that, I was a manpower director. I was the director of the War Manpower Commission. And then I got my job teaching over at McAllister College with the Army Air Corps. In the meantime, I never knew whether I was going to be in the Army or wasn't. And I had 2 children. And then I went out and took my physical exams, and they classified me 4F, primarily because of the condition I had in my lungs from the day of the pneumonia. And maybe from what my brother got tuberculin glands from tuberculin milk. I may have had a little of that when I was a boy, and it calcified on the spots in your lungs. And I went back again later on. I thought, well, we'll wait and see what happens. And I got this job teaching. And then I went down and applied for a commission in the Navy. Thought I might be able to get through that way. And I was rejected for general service in the Navy. Then I volunteered in the Navy, and I was rejected. Then they called me up again, selective service, and then I was declared 1A Limited. But that was in the summer of 1944. And by that time, I'd been in the mayor's campaign, and I didn't know what the hell I was going to do with myself. It was just hopeless. So I finished, and at that, and then I had made arrangements. Then I thought, then I surely would get in the military, and we made arrangements for Muriel to go home to Huron, and it was all a big mess. But they didn't take me. The war was coming to an end, and they had a rule that they weren't taking fathers of 2 or more children. By that time, we had 3, and so they didn't. I just didn't get called.
This newscaster job was that while you were at McAllister?
Yes, sir.
Right.
It was after while I was at McAllister, after I first run for mayor.
Right. Yeah.
And after I'd run for mayor is when I was teaching at McAllister.
Right.
And I taught from McAllister from September 1943 through June of 1945.
There was one story I read somewhere about when you were at McAllister, and I think McAllister, when the students got so interested in what you were teaching that they
Oh, we used to stay many nights.
They'd come back after dinner.
Sure, we'd go downtown to have a bite to eat, and we'd come back and study till 9:30, then we'd get in the car, they'd go over and do the broadcast. I did that many times. Those students of mine were wonderful, and I had them all over.
This was American politics,
yes,
generally?
Or we'd have readings in American government or readings
uh-huh.
in political philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember the exact courses.
Right.
But I had lots of good fun with my students. I was the commencement speaker for 14 groups of students from the Army Air Corps. They had to select by popular vote the teacher that they wanted to be their speaker, and I won every time.
Really?
Yep. And I tell you, and I got a pair of cufflinks that I still have from my students that gave me their cufflinks. And I had a lot of wonderful friends with those young people. Now
this is what?
Down at the farmer's market in Minneapolis when I was mayor, and
right.
here I am addressing the city council.
Right. And you put through that charter reform, didn't you?
Well, I tried to put through charter reform. We
yeah,
didn't succeed. Our effort was declared unconstitutional.
Mm-hmm.
But we did put through a good deal of reform in the city, in taxation and in reorganization of city government and the police department. We really had quite a...
And you really cleaned up that town.
You bet we did.
That was the... to hold this just for a minute, this was the... I mean, Minneapolis had quite a reputation there, which needed cleaning up.
It had a reputation for some gangs and for anti-Semitism and corruption, which I regrettably.
And you put in the that was when you put through the
established the first Human Rights Commission with the late Reverend Reuben Youngdahl as chairman, and we established the Mayor's Law Enforcement Committee with Bradshaw Mintner, who's here an attorney in Minneapolis in Washington now. He was the chief counsel for Pillsbury Mills as my chairman. We put through the first Fair Employment Practices Commission in the United States.
And what things did you learn as mayor that stayed with you so that when you were dealing with urban problems in the Senate, this was a background of experience that not many of your senators had.
Well, it's a lot different now than it was then. The main thing I learned then was that you could work with all the groups. I think that I've talked about this quite a little bit, and we have some other tapes on this that we did some interviews on it. That town had that's a city of 500,000. It was the 15th largest city in our country then. It had all the post-war problems of readjustment. There was a shortage of housing for the veterans.
Yes.
It had the problems of blight. We proceeded to set up our committees to make a model city. We have a big redevelopment program. By the way, we had no law. We had no state law, no nothing. I had to go and pass it. That's where we did pass a charter amendment for that. We could amend our own charter
mm-hmm.
to to establish our own housing authority. We had no law for it. And I had to come to lead the fight to get that done.
There's one story I heard about you when you were mayor, when you first got in, calling in your police chief and your top policeman and saying, look, I'm not taking any more money. I'm not taking any money, and you're not taking any.
That's right.
And but I'll get you more higher salaries.
That's
so
right.
You can.
I told the police department we was going to make it a position of honor. We organized the women's auxiliary, called in the wives of all the police officers, told them that we're not going to have people pointing at your children anymore and saying your daddy's a crooked cop. We doubled the policeman's salary. We gave him the first 40-hour week in the United States, and did that in 1947 for a police department.
My God.
And I called in the liquor dealers and told them to walk upstairs to the city council and go up there and tell them to double your license fee. Don't wait for them to ask you. Go tell them. And they didn't like that very much. But I said, that's what we've got to do, because we got to pay these police officers. Now you're going to pay it one way or another. They're either going to shake you down or you're going to pay a fee. So let's do it honorably. You go on upstairs and testify. And they did. We doubled their fees and we paid.
No.
We paid for the police department.
Well, that's a lesson to learn now. That hasn't changed very much.
No. Can be done.
I mean,
not only that, do you know that those liquor dealers became my best friends? Because I dealt with them fairly, and I never let the police department use any tricks on them. They used to have ways and means in town where they'd have kids go on in and get a drink if somebody wanted to knock them off, when the different gangs in town trying to vie for liquor licenses.
And I
won't go into the details of that, but all they wanted was a fair shake of the dice. That's all. They just didn't want. The only thing that the liquor dealers wanted to know, the tavern owners, was, are you on the square? If you're not going to play crooked ball, that's fine. But if you are, we want to get in on it,
right.
And because we got to keep
right.
operating.
Right.
Now here we are. This is the Minneapolis Millers. Rosie Ryan was the head of the ball team. He's out in Tacoma, Washington right now. He sends me a baseball every year. And I used to open the game. That's the first pitch. Boy, look at that face there.
That's intense.
And I used to go up.
Intense here.
And I used to go up and in the top booth. And when there were foul balls would come up there, I'd shag those balls and take them down to the mayor's office and give them to the kids. Here on this is out at the Grocerman's Picnic with the police band. And this is in the YWCA. YMCA. YMCA.
Yeah,
and by the way, Billy Graham used to go there too.
Is that right?
Yeah. And this fellow right here is now up at the Minneapolis Club in Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. Clarence is his name.
What's
Clarence.
This wild one?
I can't remember that, but some, most likely some...
Southside Picnic
or something, that's right. And here we are up in the, what the dickens is this? This is a policeman's band again. I used to lead that every once in a while. That was great fun. Okay. This is after...
This is the convention, isn't it?
Yeah, civil rights fight.
Right.
At the convention.
And how'd you get involved in that?
I was on the platform committee, and I came from the Democratic Farmer Labor Party, which was a liberal party. And Harry Truman had this commission to secure these rights. He appointed a citizens commission to look into the whole subject of civil rights in the United States. They'd made some recommendations, and I'd become a member of ADA, which was a non-communist liberal organization, because at that time the commies had infiltrated everything that was liberal, from the CIO to they tried to get into the ADC, and the boys beat him there, and there was one thing after another. So this was the big liberal issue of that time, and this is where we had to make our stand.
But your involvement with the Negroes as a cause...
Well, it didn't have anything,
no,
you know.
Negroes.
I never really felt that civil rights was just for Negroes.
Yeah.
I figured it was for people.
For everybody.
You know, this is the thing that bothers me down east here. Everybody's got to put a tag on everybody.
Yeah.
I think they ought to just look at them as people.
Yeah.
I don't want to blink my eyes at the realities, but a lot of people don't have their civil rights. The Indian doesn't have his civil rights. The Puerto Rican didn't have his civil rights. That poor Mexican-American doesn't have his civil rights.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of people in my community that were Jewish people that didn't have their civil rights.
Yeah.
There was anti-Semitism was rampant.
It was, I think Gunther said it was the worst.
Well, next to Boston.
Yeah.
Kerry McWilliams,
yeah.
Well, we did something about those things.
Yeah.
And we just organized people and just did something about it.
Well, what about this particular fight?
I was on that platform committee, and we were fighting hard in the committee to try to get a better plank, and... when we didn't get it,
the odds were against you, weren't they?
We got a majority plank. It was a really pretty good plank.
Yeah.
But after we got it, we looked it over, and it didn't really say all it should say. And quite frankly, we knew that the Republicans would most likely be saying something strong at that time. But more importantly, it was the issue of the time, like the city today. The urban crisis is an issue, or Vietnam is an issue for some people. This was the issue then. This was where you separated the men from the boys. This is where you separated the liberal from the stand patter. And we were young liberals, young Turks, as they call it. That's where we made our stand. And when I look back at the stand we made, it seems very timid now and very modest.
Very credible at the time.
Yeah. But at the time, it was a major challenge.
Major victory. There you are.
I could, was it hot that day? I remember. Was it hot? Oh, boy.
In more ways than one.
Yeah, and I remember that when I got up there, Boss Flynn, Ed Flynn, from New York, I talked to him. And I was just frightened, so getting up there on that platform, I'd never been before a convention that big. And I'd been told I'd rue the day that I ever did this. And I'd been told that this would destroy me and the Democratic Party. The chairman of the platform committee was Francis Myers, who was a wonderful senator from Pennsylvania, a liberal.
Real liberal, yeah.
I went over to see Ed Flynn and told him what I had in mind and showed him a copy of what I was going to say and a copy of the resolution. And he'd never forget what he said to me. I told him all the background. I told him what people were saying. Scott Lucas thought it was a terrible mistake for me. And he said to me, well, young man, he said, this is something that's needed to be done for a long time. He said, these so-and-sos have been referring to the segregationists and the Southerners at that time, have been getting by with this kind of politics too long. You go ahead and do it. I'll back you. And I just thought, my goodness, isn't it? And now I feel some hope. But I said, I'm sure that I can't win, because I was almost apologetic to him, you know, saying, I hope you won't think I'm too bad, but I want to do this, and I've got to do it. And he said, well, go ahead and do it. And I said, but he said, you'll get New York. And I said, will I? He said, of course you will. And he said, you'll get Pennsylvania, too. And I said, oh, I can't get Pennsylvania. Francis Myers is the chairman. He said, you'll get Pennsylvania, and you'll get Illinois. So they can talk all they want to about bosses.
Yeah.
I'll tell you.
If you
just have there's a difference.
Yeah.
It's a question of, if they're against you, you call them bosses.
Yeah.
If they're for you, you call them leaders.
Political leaders, yeah.
And these fellows were for us. And it was the bosses, so to speak, of Illinois and New York and New Jersey and Pennsylvania that put it over. They were the ones that stood their ground. A lot of the others didn't, and they went and we won it. Well, there we are.
When did you first meet him?
I met Harry Truman the first when he ran for vice president with Franklin Roosevelt. We put on a meeting for him in the Dyckman Hotel in Minneapolis. And then I met him after that.
You were the state leader running the...
Yes.
Right.
Yep.
Did he... Do you remember anything he said to you at that time?
No,
or?
I don't. I regret to
right.
say I was so scared I couldn't remember things. This is the fall of 1948 when we went down to Chicago for the Midwest Democratic Conference. We had our displays. There's my dear friend Paul Douglas, and there's Adlai.
Was the first time you met him?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir, and the first time I'd met Adlai.
Remember anything about that? About him then? Or?
Well, I remember at the time that that no one thought that any of us were going to win.
Really, anything?
Not a one.
Right.
Everybody was gloomy, and it didn't look like you had a chance.
You all did.
We all won, and big. Paul won a major victory. And they didn't expect him to win. I remember people telling me there was no hope that he could win.
What kind of man was Stevenson then?
Well, I got to know him in more so after then. I didn't really get to know him too well
mm-hmm.
then. But you know, he looked stocky and chubby
yeah,
then.
Yeah,
just
he sure
like,
does, yeah.
Now, this is when I went out to see my mother and dad. After I'd been...
Your father had been a delegate at that convention.
Yes, sir, from South Dakota.
And
he cast the vote.
Yeah, that was a proud thing.
Yes, sir, he cast the vote for us on the civil rights. My dad did that. I have a wonderful picture of Dad and myself sitting up in the room in the Bellevue Stratford.
Yeah, I have that picture, and I think we're going to use it right over here, I think. Instead of this one, maybe.
Yeah. This is my brother, Ralph, right here.
On that one.
Right here. I want you to keep that in here if you can. He's... There I am here in Muriel, and this is the gang gathered around our, there's Gene Sims right there, right here.
I think this must be Art Naflin.
That's Art Naflin.
And this is when you came back from the
Civil rights fight in the convention.
Right. This is that the convention?
No, this is when I came
back,
to the railroad station.
Right, mm-hmm. right, right.
Freddie Gates had organized this.
Yeah, Freddie's in here too.
Yeah. And this is, you know who that is, that's the woman that worked, it was a state legislator, you know, the one who worked for Carl Rovog.
Sally Luther?
Sally Luther.
My God.
Let me see Sally. She hasn't changed one
No. Now this is up at, this is at...
Jane Freeman, I think.
This is at Brainerd, Minnesota, 1948.
Convention.
Yeah.
Oh,
Democratic Convention.
And this is all the stuff they gave you, the be on the square and the cut the red
yeah,
tape and
yeah,
hammer
right.
away.
Yeah,
and,
that's right. After
and the
I've been elected.
Rule.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who gave you all that stuff?
I don't know. What's the matter?
Oh, I'm just getting antsy about keeping you.
Hey, are you? Okay.
Yeah.
Here we are. This is 1952.
1956.
1960, yeah. Good Lord.
Now tell me about Stevenson. This is the Stevenson
well,
part, really.
I got Adlai Stevenson was a was for other people almost what he was for himself. He was a an enigma in many ways, but he was a very modest man. He was almost a shy man, but he was an awfully sweet man, and he was kind of a mixture of politician and poet. He really, he had some of the, McCarthy has some of his qualities. The difference is that I think Attlee was more, was a more determined man than Gene. He was an administrator. He was a good governor.
Yes, he was.
Very good governor. Something that people didn't quite understand.
No, they never got known much, but it's
very,
true.
Very good governor. He had a great sense of humor. Oftentimes self-deprecating, but a wonderful sense of humor. He had a difficult time being tough, but that I always, I'd have trouble that way too for a long period of time, so I forgive him for that. The best thing about Attlee Stevenson was that he was a nobleman, you know, really noble of spirit and noble of character, noble of word. He was a refined man. He was class, he was quality. And he did the best, you know, it's an interesting thing what role people serve in life. There is a plan to life, there's no doubt about it. The older you get, the more you know about it. During the period of defeat, when the Democratic Party could have become bitter and cynical and nasty and backbiting, I mean, and really a dirty opposition, a mean opposition, he breathed a new spirit into this party. He made people like myself and others feel that there was something worth fighting for and worth looking forward to. He kept your sense of idealism going rather than your sense of just the punitive attack upon the opposition.
What are some of your personal memories about him?
Stories that stick in your mind for years?
I know there are millions, but...
One of my memories is when he came to Minnesota, how he always used to like to come up there and see us. I was so different from him that he really enjoyed the company, and I enjoyed the company with him because he was so different. We lived in different worlds, and we sort of were, we both had a great respect for the other fellow. I know that he had it for me, and I'm positive I had it for him. He just never could get over that we really liked politics, and that he couldn't get over that we'd go to all these meetings and travel all
enjoy
over the state and enjoy it. And that we'd like to make speeches and like to stay up half the night. He just couldn't get over all that. He really just reveled in the experience of being in Minnesota with our gang up there, with Freeman and Rollbog and Humphrey and all of us, because we were kind of a rugged type for him. It was a hard, rough-going, hard-hitting, raring-to-go, spirited political operation. And many of the places that he went, he didn't have that. I remember when one of the memories I have is after the 60 campaign, when he was dubious as to whether he should take a role in the government. And I said, you have to. I met with him up at Bill Benton's apartment in New York. I said, you don't have any choice about that, Attlee. You elected, you helped elect John Kennedy. You went all around the country like I did, saying that he should be president. Now he wants you to do something. You can't go around and say that you didn't mean it. You have an obligation to take the assignment. He wanted to be Secretary of State, and of course, when he was asked to be UN ambassador, it was a letdown. And I just got after him. I really went after him and said, you just don't have any choice. And at the time, I had been offered the majority whip's job. And he didn't think I ought to take it. He thought I ought to keep myself free. That he said, the minute you take that job, you are bound to the administration. And you ought to be a free man. That's your future. Well, always having people tell me that. But as I said, look, we went out and worked for him. We told people that Kennedy should be president. We told him that he was going to do something for this country. Now, when he asked us to do something, don't you think we ought to line up, or are we just going to enjoy on the fringes? Attlee had this sort of, he would have kind of liked to have been left out on the fringes, because it gives you a little more freedom of operation. It gives you the chance to be an intellectual, a critic, and an intellectual participant without all that responsibility. But once that we really had it out, and Bill Benton could tell you more about it. And I said, I picked up the telephone, and that I'd been called right there from Washington by Lyndon Johnson, and said that the president and I want you to be the majority whip. And you can get the votes. And I said, I'll think it over. And I called him back right in their presence of Benton and Stevenson, said, I accept. I'll take it any minute. And the argument was that this sealed me now. In other words, you're locked in. You're no longer a free man.
This decision was made right in that room.
Yes, sir.
Within how long?
Within a couple of hours.
I see.
And it also was made in that room that he was going to take on that UN job.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because I said, you don't have any choice. And he recognized that. But we had many wonderful times together. Great humor. We used to go up and just see each other in New York, and I'd go visit with him at the United Nations. He liked Muriel. He was always very nice, and we'd stay at his apartment up there in New York once in a while when we'd go up there. It's hard for me to remember all the little things, but it was always a warm friendship and fellowship, and he had a very soft spot in his heart for me. In fact, the nicest thing I think about it all is that he was talking to Eric Severi the night before he died about our relationship. That's a high compliment for him.
Yes, it is.
And I just looked upon him as one of the, well, you know, one of those priceless spirits. It's one of the rare privileges of public life to get to meet a man like this. These are the rewards. This is like a businessman would find a stock that multiplied in value 1,000-fold by a lucky investment. I found a man by a lucky contact, by just fact that I ran for office in 1948, and it amplified and magnified 1,000-fold in fellowship and friendship and idealism. And I don't know, it's sort of a spiritual experience. You know, you people say, well, what happened? You don't really know what happened. What is it that makes for love between man and woman? You know, there's a lot of intangibles. You don't know what makes all this.
Strange chemistry.
And it is. And people are not... most of the people that I really like are not very much like me.
That's interesting.
Yeah, very different. Because I have enough of me about all I can take. and you know, you have to get something else. So here we are up at the
United Nations.
Yeah, and there's Adlai there. See, look at that look on him.
Yeah,
see? And there's Paul Hoffman. And I forgot now what I was addressing myself to at the time.
But you were there for as a representative.
Oh, this was the night that I spoke to the Pacem in Terris conference. Pacem in Terris.
What was that about?
Now this is after that.
Right.
This was.
That was Stevenson's funeral.
Yeah, this is Stevenson's funeral.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, that was his death was the end of an era in a sense too. Now this is a testimony before.
That's your announcement.
Announcement.
In West Virginia.
Oh yes.
Before we leave Stevenson, did you feel in in 56, that he had given you any kind of commitment on the vice presidency?
Yes, I maybe misread that. I did, yes, sir. The commitment that he gave me, that I understood, was that if I could go out and build up some support, that I could get that I would be given the nod to the vice presidency.
Mm-hmm.
That was a very interesting thing. I had a long meeting with him at the Mayflower Hotel in 56.
This was with Kampelman and also
with
Bill Blair.
I think Bill Blair was there. That's correct. I kind of rubbed those things out of my memory because you got to remember in politics it's
I better flip this.
Said Norman tonight, very few people in politics seem to like each other. It's sort of like a group of prima donnas, ballerinos and orchestra conductors. You hardly ever find two conductors of an orchestra that like each other. They pretend they do, but they really don't. Every time I go in a place, I politics, anybody that's any leaders, they generally don't really go for each other. It's a very competitive business, highly competitive. It's a form of warfare that's been somewhat civilized. And it's continuing. It's really the 100 Years' War without any peace treaties, some truces here and there.
We're all hawks.
But 1956, I felt that Adlai did not want at that time, that I gathered he did not want Estes as his not running mate. There had been some talk about Bob Wagner. I had a long talk with him about it. He said to me in so many words, well, why don't you speak for yourself? And I took the message and went out and tried to raise a little money and raise some support. It was another one of the experiences of growing up.
But the thing that always impressed me, I was there at that convention in 56, when they opened it up, and it was a thing that had been brewing. But what impressed me was, I remember John Sharon telling me that your reaction so soon afterwards. I mean, here was a blast. You didn't expect it to come out of nowhere. You had no troops. You had no money. You had
No.
No equipment, you had, and you really caught short. And yet, after the thing was done, when right after Stevenson sort of called up to apologize, I could quote the scriptures, he said, or something like that, John said, he said, you were right back there, you were in full support, you were in full steam, you were, you were part of, this was the resilience, the ability to come back like a real professional, instead of going off in the corner, and this was the big
life
thing.
Life is too short.
Well,
for that. I don't mean to be noble about that, but I just never feel that way about things. I know that this is going to happen to you a lot of times. You just have to know in life that you're going to get tripped up, and you can just spend all your time figuring out why did that guy do that to me. It isn't worth it. It really isn't. Not if you want to live a good life. I mean, a happy life or a reasonably productive life. The worst thing that happens to a man in politics is to overly reminisce, and secondly, to seek vindication.
And here's the perfect case of it, West Virginia.
Now, you seek vindication and you're through, because you lose all sense of judgment from there on out, because everything centers on you and how you rationalize your own position, how you vindicate your own position, no matter what you do to anybody else to get it done, no matter what you do to truth. And the minute I see a man in politics that seeks vindication, and I see a lot of the older timers around, I say, get rid of him. That's right away, because he'll just trip you up. He's just no good. You got every day is a new day. The books are closed every night for all practical purposes. And don't expect too much from people. Don't expect too much. That's the main thing you got to keep in mind. Everything is not as important to other people as it may be to you. They have something that's important that may not be in your value scheme. But if you keep thinking that everything that you think is important to the other man, you're going to be very disappointed. And you just sort of have to assume that people have problems of their own. Everybody's a little selfish, a little prejudiced. Just can't expect people to do everything the way you want them to. I really don't. I get angry once in a while at people and snort around, but really I don't expect very much. You have to just keep, I guess what I'm really trying to say is that what you think is important is not always important to the other fellow. Not even the commitment that he makes to you may be that important. You generally hear what you want to hear, you know. I mean, I can listen to people talk to me now about delegates and hear all kinds of things. Some of my people are hearing things that aren't quite there. But I want it loud and clear, because in this game of politics, it's like an alliance. Allies, watch what's happened to us in Southeast Asia. Where did the allies go? They find a lot of little loopholes in those laws. And when you're in battle, there's a lot of people that don't turn up. And you can hear, oh gosh, you can just hear noises that just come running through your head. You just think you just hear everything you want to hear.
Everything you want to hear, that's
right
you
there.
You hear what you want to hear.
That's right. And so if you just keep in mind that the other fellow may not be quite as serious about this as you are. Now, this is the debate in West Virginia. This is where we were at one of the mining communities in West Virginia. I want to tell you about West Virginia. I never in my life went into a state in which I felt a greater warmth of the people than in West Virginia in 1960. When Muriel and I went in there after Wisconsin, the first few weeks I felt we were going to win West Virginia. About 2 weeks before the election, I knew we weren't going to win West Virginia, because the politics in West Virginia of that year was a different kind of politics than we were accustomed to playing.
In what way?
Well, it was money politics. You were slated, so to speak, and you were playing for big chips.
Was that the lesson of West Virginia money?
Money and organization. But really, in politics, most people have money. It's whether you know how to use it. Some people know how to use money and other people don't. And if you don't have it and don't know how to use it,
well,
you're even in double jeopardy.
Double trouble, yeah.
But we didn't have it. We had no real money. We were terribly broke in West Virginia, just hopelessly out. And it's all a story that I just soon kind of
forget.
All right,
then let's pass it over quickly. There it is.
Yeah, there's Mom. That's one of the prettiest pictures. Muriel was brokenhearted. Women take these things much more seriously than men do. I take them seriously, and so does she, but the real truth is that a woman's feelings are more involved. They're much more subjective. That's why in many ways they're much better than men. you get a woman on your side, boy, and she'll really go, she'll break her heart for you. She'll do anything. Man, most men are not that way. They'll deliver about so much. But if they're against you, wow.
What was your wife's feeling about politics in general, aside from West Virginia?
Well, Muriel, I've been a political man a long time. Somebody had to bring up the family. And Muriel really took on the extra burden of the family. Here's Douglas here. Here's my boy, Dougie, working with his mother out that trailer there, you know,
mm-hmm.
serving coffee there. Here he is peddling out literature.
Mm-hmm.
She had to bring up the boys and the daughter pretty much. I gave them as my love and attention when I had the time. But we came up the hard way, all the way. And it was really just hard work. We didn't have any big PR outfit. Didn't have any big backers. Come from a western state. One of the reasons I want to get to be president is that I think just like President Johnson became president from the South, I think it's time for a Midwesterner to be president of the United States. This is one country, it's just about time people found it out. And we came down here to the east. They didn't have much help. So we had to do it the hard way. Build it up brick by brick. Nobody come along and said, we'll build this side of the house for you. And now, Muriel, I think in the 60 campaign, she did a beautiful job for me in Wisconsin. Very good. And she was very good in West Virginia. And she is a woman that has grown more beautiful with age. She was much prettier in 60 than she was in 50. And I think she was more beautiful here the other day when I declared my candidacy than she's ever been.
Mm-hmm.
I regret she's been, you know, this operation has knocked her for a loop now for a while. But I think she'll come back from that. And she likes it now. I mean, she accepts it and likes it. I can't say she's always enjoyed it, because politics is a very demanding profession. It demands everything of you, total commitment of your energies and your spirit and your vitality. It's just almost total. I try not to let it be total, because I've got to have some other little joys in life. But that's about the way it is.
Right. Okay.
Yep. Now there we are.
There are the Kennedys.
Yep, that's
we'll
right.
This one over
there.
There's
I like Jackie. And always have. She was always very nice to us. And Teddy is a good... I don't dislike any of them. It would be very... You know, I must be honest with you. I don't have any of these dislikes. And I always said I didn't want any more fights with the Kennedys. I had no more intention of ever running against Bobby than the man in the moon. I didn't ever intend to run in 1972. I figured I'd be vice president again. Unless I had been vice president and something happened to the president.
Yeah,
and I was an incumbent president.
Well, that is different.
Then I would have...
But you really had decided not to run in 72.
Yes, on my own.
Yes.
Yes, I had that all behind me, very neatly tucked behind me, my own mind. But I felt that I ought to be ready in case if anything ever happened to the president. You know, life is so uncertain.
Right.
And I like this young fellow particularly, and
Teddy,
his wife,
yeah.
Teddy and Joan. And I like Bob and Ethel, I really do. I mean, I think that there's a lot of people try to pit us against each other. And I maybe don't know, I really don't know enough about them to dislike them and enough about them to be deeply involved in a personal relationship.
Right.
But his views are pretty much the same as my views on a lot of things. We disagree on the war. I think he's a very ambitious young man, but a lot of us are and have been. I don't feel quite as ambitious as I used to.
What about John F.?
Well, I liked him very much. And I really got to like him immensely after he became president and just before he became president. I even liked him during the campaign. I used to envy him because he was so good, the way he had it coming for him. And he had style and class, and he was full of vitality. We had a good time over in the Senate. We used to joke a lot. I never knew him too much as a senator. I knew him more as a fellow, a friend over there. We'd talk a great deal even during the primary. I remember one time he told me, he said that I think if you could get nominated, you'd be the strongest candidate. But he said, I don't think you can get nominated.
Did he say that really?
Yeah. And I felt I would too.